Suppose a group has a million, or even 10 million members. Could they possibly work together without collapsing into total chaos? Well, they can, if they're part of an ant colony. This is why scientists describe certain species of ants as superorganisms, because the colony itself often acts as if it's one giant animal. So how do ants do it? That's the question that biologists E.O. Wilson and Bert Holdobler explore in a book called The Superorganism. Wilson is an eminent Harvard biologist who may know more about ants than any other person on Earth. Steve Paulson talked with E.O. Wilson about the marvels of the ant world.
How big are the biggest colonies of social insects?
They range from as few as 10 individuals all the way up to, it's believed, in excess of 20 million in the driver ants of Africa. And mind you, those 20 million are all daughters of a single mother ant.
That's phenomenal. 20 million children of one queen. That's
mother of the year, hands down.
So how big a territory, just in terms of actual geographical space, would this 20 million ant colony extend over?
They march at frequent intervals, the driver ants of Africa. And I don't think it's that they defend the territory, but they're constantly on the move. The same is true of the army ants, which are almost up in that class of hugeness. They have upwards of a million. And they don't really have territories. They avoid each other. And as they sweep along with these daily raids, catching everything they can get their mandibles on, they clean out the area of small creatures, grasshoppers, other ants, even small mice, if they can catch them, and so on, to the extent that when an army ant colony or a driver ant colony, one, comes through, then it leaves behind a relatively barren area.
Hmm. Now, there are some other giant colonies of ants, I mean, of different species, that are more sedentary. Isn't the leafcutter ant like that?
Yeah, these are what we call the ultimate superorganisms because they build gigantic nests and further are able to build the immense populations, which go to over 3 million, maybe as high as 5 million in some cases, again, daughters of a single queen, by using fresh vegetation. They're the only creature we know that can harvest fresh vegetation and use it, not to eat it directly, but by using it as a substrate to raise fungi. And in that way, it is a true agriculturist.
You're saying they're actually farmers growing this stuff.
They are farmers.
So how, yeah. I mean, what boggles the mind is how you could have so many ants, I mean, millions of ants in a single colony, how you could organize all of those organisms.
That's what Bert Holdobler and I have spent our scientific lifetimes unraveling. In the case of the super organism, the leafcutter ants, there are a graded series of casts of different sizes, and they have different shapes to their heads. They have different, you know, size of glands that they use to communicate with, and they have very different functions. As you go from little guys, which are, they may be one or a half a millimeter across the head, all the way up to giants with heads 5 to 6 millimeters. The little guys in these leafcutter colonies are the gardeners. They are the ones that take intimate care of the fungus that's growing on which the colony depends for food. And then up around the middle size, say their heads are about 2 millimeters across, you have the ones that come out, the foragers. They're the ones you mostly see out on these long trails through the rainforest and grasslands of the tropics. They go and find the plants and then cut the leaves, scissor off pieces of leaves that they can carry back to the nest. And there are a number of sizes in between that size and the smallest that perform the functions of preparing the fresh leaves or fresh flowers sometimes they bring in. They have to be chewed into a pulp by these intermediate-sized ants.
Now, presumably, they have to communicate with each other, don't they? Sort of.
They do.
To tell each other what they're doing?
Well, let me tell you about the giants first.
Okay.
When you go up to those huge guys, they have grotesquely large heads. And these are large because they are packed with muscles that pull almost razor-sharp mandibles together. And it's our belief that, we know they're defensive. That's a defensive cast. But it appears that they're defenders especially against, guess what? Anteaters. Hmm. And other larger animals that could invade the nest.
So presumably, all these ants, these millions of ants, have to somehow talk to each other. They have to tell each other what they're doing. How do they do that?
It was only the 1960s that we began to work that out. They talk almost exclusively, let's say 95% plus, by pheromones, by chemical substances that they release from their bodies. And you know they have glands all up and down their bodies from the tip of their heads way back to the tip of the last segment on their body that are used in communication. And these signals can be combined. They can be modulated in terms of where they are released to give different meanings. And the ants build up quite a vocabulary just by smelling and tasting each other.
What are some of the different kinds of signals they might emit?
Start with alarm substances. If you disturb, let's go back to our leafcutter ants. If you go back to, say, the surface of these huge nests they build, and the nest may be 10 meters across, and they go down 8 meters into the soil, they'll be swarming with the ants, or columns coming and going. If you disturb them badly, just stir them around and push them around, they release from glands in their heads an alarm substance. Then the ants are alarmed. They go into a little frenzy or very excited, running about looking for an enemy. So then they'll converge on that spot. Another pheromone is the trail substance. And it's chemicals, pheromones, that are laid down and pass from the nest where the ants are to objects far away. These objects can be food that someone has just discovered in the colony. It can be an enemy that seems to be approaching. It has the effect not just of guiding the other ants in, it has the effect of exciting them.
Hmm. Now, in terms of all these worker ants, and in some cases these millions of ants that might live in one colony, what sex are they?
They're all female.
All females?
Oh, yes. Believe me, this is liberalism run amok.
There are just a few males who are around to mate, and then once they've done their business, they leave or they die?
Oh, yes. There have to be males, you know, to have a mixture of genes and keep strength up of adaptability of the next generation of colonies. But these males, they're built for only one thing. They're winged, sperm-carrying missiles that mate once with a queen, a virgin queen, when the colony releases simultaneously at the appropriate year, part of the year, these swarms of virgin queens that are going to start the new colonies, and the males with them, swarms of males that mate with them. The males are distinctively, how shall I put it, handicapped in many ways. They have smaller brains. They have huge eyes, which help orient when they go out looking for a queen. They have tiny mandible jaws, almost no jaws at all in many cases. They have to be fed by their sisters, and they don't do any work. They just sit there waiting for the big moment, which is that flight out in the air and, you know, one mating maybe, and the majority usually don't mate at all. And then what do the males do? They do what they're supposed to do. They die. They can't go back to the nest. The queen, they would just be driven away. Their muscles will be quickly picked up by birds and lizards and other ants and so on. Few males last more than a day or two. I'm sorry if this, you know, this is disturbing.
It's kind of a dismal
news.
Life, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you just don't want to be a male. However, if you're a queen, now that's a different matter. If you're one of these young queens, you know, which has a few minutes of excitement in the air. She settles down. And we have records now of queen ants that started a colony. They lay eggs, you know, raise their first brood of workers, their daughters, first brood of daughters. And they start the colony, and that grows and grows and grows. And then finally it reaches a size after a few years. In some cases, like the fire ant, within 1 year, they're producing new queens and ready to breed or to reproduce themselves as a colony. But some queens, in extreme cases, have been recorded as living over 20 years. They're the oldest insects in the world that we know of.
That's entomologist E.O. Wilson talking with Steve Paulson. Wilson's the co-author with Bert Holdobler of the book The Superorganism.